Chairman, in the place of Michael Lillian, who cannot afford to be here today. It's a very hot day, so the official Foreign Office advice will be you may take your coats off, although it's a matter of discretion if you want to put them on again. That aside, let us turn to the business. This is an age of hybrid organisations, or organisations that are changing their nature, and often facing both ways, riding two horses, and so on and so forth. And I mean, many of us in Parliament are inclined to see the British Council, which does a fantastic job as a sort of instrument of British power and persuasion and influence. But of course, it isn't just that, and it's not only that. And if it was that only, it wouldn't be nearly so effective as it is. And it takes on more subtle and complex, but highly effective line in establishing its own influence and persuasion, and its own brand of persuasion across the globe. So this is, to us all, a very important instrument, but one we mustn't sort of, the politicians must not, never be allowed to kill with love or embrace in the wrong way. Now, this morning we've got Sir Kieran Devin, the Chief Executive, to speak to us. Hasn't been executive very long, but already very well known. Did a fantastic job, of course, at Macmillan Cancer Support, which is duly famous already. And he's done a terrible string of other things, which I won't delay you with, because what we want to do is hear from him. I noticed in his CV, he's a biochemical engineer. I think we need a rather few more of those in the world, where the technology is leading many of us down. But enough said, and I've now got a very great pleasure to introduce Sir Kieran Devin to speak to you on the theme of soft power and hard choices. I think I got that right.
You did. Thank you. Good afternoon. Right, well, pleasure to be here, and it's a privilege to be the Chief Exec of the British Council. And I think the reason I was very keen to apply for the job and thrilled to get the job was really because of a course I did in Washington when I did a master's there roughly 10 years ago. And there was a course by a sinologist on democratization, and with what are the things which make for a good democracy. And of course, it wasn't about the elections, it was about lots of other things as well. It was around rule of law, and it was around institutions, and it was around free press, and so on. So I got fascinated by the topic. So when the opportunity came up to apply, of course, I did. So what I'd like to talk about is a bit about soft power, but also about the British way of doing soft power, because there are different definitions. Joseph Nye, who's an academic in the States, was the person who came up with the phrase, and he wrote a book, and it became a vogue, talking about soft power and smart power versus hard power. So it's probably worth spending a few minutes just talking about the definition as I see it. The simplest definition of soft power, because it is a collective phrase, it's a collective noun, is kind of not hard power, which sounds obvious. So it's not the military end, it's the rest. So what does that cover? Well, it covers what the Foreign Office would call diplomatic excellence. It covers cultural diplomacy, where culture is used to, you know, from an instrumental point of view, create relationships. We want to be nice to this country. Can we put on a series of events in that country, and it'll be a good excuse to convene. It could be public diplomacy, which is a state or an embassy talking to the people of a particular country, risks being over the head of the government, so not always liked in all parts of the world. It could be cultural relations, which is what we think we do, which I'll talk a bit more about. Or it could be forward engagement, which is one of the phrases the Americans use a lot. It's doing things now which will help engage people who will be useful in 10 years, 20 years' time. In many ways, it's all of those. And it's really around saying, in the spectrum of tools available to a state, you've got the very hard end of hard power, you've got military itself, you've got military relationships, you've got diplomacy, you've got cultural relations, you've got the BBC. You know, a very good example of soft power was when the Prime Minister was in China, and one of the questions he was asked at a particular talk was, when's the next episode of Sherlock? And you know, that's about relationships, about people understanding a little bit more about somebody else's culture. So within all of that, how do we do it as Britain? And we talk about cultural relations. We don't talk about soft power. And the reason for that is being slightly sensitive to this thing about being instrumental. It's what Lord Howe was saying, that we should not be an organisation which says, right, we've got this foreign policy objective, be it around security or the prosperity agenda. Can you do this for this reason? And please do the following. Because if we do that, what we are not doing is building the relationships between people and countries. And I want to take us back to 1940. And I've been walking around for the last 6 months. It's exactly 6 months today I was appointed and started. So I've been wandering around, but I've been carrying this with me, which is our annual report for 1940-41. Now, annual reports can be dull. This one is not. This one is a beautiful piece of draftsmanship. And it talks about the Council's aim. And the Council's aim is to create in a country overseas a basis of friendly knowledge and understanding of the people of this country, of their philosophy and way of life, which will lead to a sympathetic appreciation of our foreign policy, whatever for the moment that may be, and from whatever political conviction it may spring. So what it's saying is it's not about the pursuit of the foreign policy. It is about creating this basis of friendly knowledge and understanding. And it goes on to talk about, and you could write this today, the annihilation of distance in the modern world have brought the different races and civilizations of the world rapidly and violently together. So even then they were worrying about this thing around, the world's getting smaller, it's getting more connected, how are we going to deal with this? Well, let's give a royal charter to this thing called the British Council. And it says that the constant interchange of knowledge, ideas and discoveries was always the way of life of Europe in its wiser days, and rightly now no less the way of life of the world. To foster that interchange in the interest of peaceful and happy international relationships is rightly to be regarded as the function of the prudent state. So what they were talking about is that the goal is to create connections, it's to create interchange. You don't know what will happen, you're not pursuing a particular goal in doing that. But by creating those relationships, good things will happen. You don't know what they are, but ultimately the world will be a better place and a safer place and a more prosperous place. But you do it by building those relationships. And that, for me, is the role of the British Council. And if they can think that in 40-41, so Battle of Britain, the Blitz, and they can sit in an office in King Charles Street and write that, then surely it's appropriate that we consider its use now. So what are the principles of soft power? The first one, and this is where I think Joseph and I got it right, is it's about attraction. It's about if people like you, then they're more likely to listen to you. So I think that has to be one. The second principle is about mutuality. You have to be prepared to learn yourself. You have to be prepared to be changed yourself through this interchange. And in the old days, I suppose, the British Council would have been good at, let's send a theatre group from the UK out to show you how good our playwrights are. Shakespeare is marvellous, you can't get enough Shakespeare, we'll send you lots of Shakespeare. These days, it's around saying, actually, it's about, by all means, let's support a theatre group who wants to go to whatever country, but do it in partnership with a theatre group in that country, have an exchange, see what happens, learn about, theatre in Colombia. But by the way, it's not only the playwrights and the actors who meet, it's also the technicians. You know, maybe they should share some skills as well and learn techniques and things from each other. So the idea is to create a broad range of connections, which mean that we all understand each other a bit more, and therefore these good things are likely to happen and bad things are less likely to happen. But it's not about the bit of the soft power argument, which is, can we get them out there to like what we like and to want what we want? It isn't about that, certainly not the way that we do it. So the challenge for us, I think, as the British Council, and the challenge for Britain in terms of soft power, is trying to understand how that works in the modern world. Because the world is changing, and if I can draw an analogy, my background is largely health in one way or another, and I'm fascinated by the parallel, strangely, between the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and modern extremism in North Africa more broadly, because we're seeing the same mechanisms kicking in. So traditionally, Ebola, scary disease, horrible disease, but it was never seen as a global threat because the connectivity wasn't there. People were not getting on planes and going. So while if you contract Ebola, it will probably, high probability of it killing you. But the chances of it actually spreading and becoming a global epidemic were seen as being quite small. In the modern world, where people are travelling, somebody could easily get on a plane in Freetown and head off to Monrovia. It became this different thing because it wasn't that the disease changed; it was that the transmission factor changed. So there were more mechanisms for the transmission to take place. Now, if you and I hope it's not too stretched an analogy, but if you look at extremism in North Africa now, there are always people who think strange things, prepared to be violent, prepared to be intolerant, prepared to impose their will. In the modern world, they're just more connected because that's what the internet is doing. Now, to control the Ebola outbreak, it wasn't about better treatment. It was still 70% of people who died of Ebola. It was all about controlling the transmission. It was about identifying people, isolating them, changing the practices, changing the funeral rites, which had been there for centuries, to reduce the ability for the disease to transfer. So one of our challenges then is how do we change the transmission factor of extremism? And some of that can be active, which probably nothing to do with us, taking down people's websites. Some of it is actually creating alternative conversations, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But thinking about this in a holistic way, I think, is going to be very important. The other interesting thing about what's changing in the world is who is doing this extremism. They are not the poorest, and they are not the most uneducated. If you look at the research in Pakistan, support for extremism is higher in the middle classes than it is in those with poverty. Even in Tunisia, if you look at Sifuddin Rezgui, the gunman, he was an engineer. He wasn't uneducated, he was an engineer. So what was it that in his environment meant that he went one path, not the other? Some of it is around the form of education. I think an engineering degree in Tunisia will be more academic, it'll be more by rote, it'll be less complicated. The universities won't have debating societies that some of us all took part with. So the education you end up is slightly different. So you can analyse what's happening in terms of the deficit of skills which are learned through education, as much as the level of attainment as well. So I think, therefore, the world we're going into, where we've got digital, for example, allowing this transmission to take place in a completely different way, and ISIS have been exploiting that hugely. We've got vast numbers of people going through challenged education systems, coming out the other end, not necessarily employable, into an economy which does not necessarily have the jobs for them. Therefore, how are we going to cope with that? It's the quote that is it H.G. Wells who said that education, our civilization, rather, is a race between education and catastrophe. If you talk to the education minister in Pakistan, absolutely worried about education, but worried about the youth bulge as well. It's the same when you talk to the minister in Egypt. It's the same when you talk to the minister in South Africa. So this race between how are we going to deal with these vast numbers of young people moving through education systems is one of the major challenges for us, which, if you go back to the documents from 1940, one of the major tools that we use as the British Council is about education, and I'll come back to that in a little more. And I suppose it's why, you know, in my job, I was very pleased to hear the Prime Minister saying in the wake of the attack in Tunisia that there should be a full spectrum response. So not just military, not just diplomatic, but the full spectrum. And I think the, you know, for me, I think that's right. We need to think, what is the soft power version of this? Bearing in mind that the timescale is different. You know, if you're trying to build relationships, you know, change the narrative in a society, support a society to develop its own narrative, then that's not a two-year program. It's not a security clampdown. It's something much more long-term. And doing that, I think, we can see where it works well and we can see where it doesn't work so well. Allegedly, and I think I'm allowed to say this, but please don't tweet it, there was a meeting during the surge in Iraq where Petraeus allegedly sort of thumped the table and said, look, you guys, you're trying to militarise everything. What we need is more of the British Council around here. So you can imagine a British Council surge through Iraq. But he wasn't wrong. It was a man saying, actually, a lot of the issue is not military, it's about relationships. If you look at some of the good work that was done in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was around, you know, working with communities to build relationships between them as well. So this concept of a full spectrum response, I think, is important, probably more than important, probably vital in the literal sense of that. So, but the question becomes, what might it look like? And what might our contribution to that be? Again, I suppose there are a few things. If I look at, let me talk about two programs which we're involved in, which I've been to see. Let me talk about three, actually. The first one is what we call Young Arab Voices. If you're a young Arab, you're supposed to be seen and not heard in many countries. You know, this idea of talking back to your elders just doesn't happen. And this idea of debating topics just doesn't happen. You don't do it at home, you don't do it at school, you don't do it at university. So the skills that we grew up with, where you know, being on the school debating team was almost as good as being on the school football team, it just isn't part of how things happen. So what we do is we work with young emerging leaders to help them train people in how to debate, to run debating competitions, in the belief that, in the long term, two things will happen. One is we're working with the future leaders. The second one is we are helping change the narrative in society and creating some alternative pathways. And doing that at scale, like thousands upon thousands of young people, can have an impact, but only if you stick at it year after year after year. It's the cumulative effect, it's the compound interest that works over time. The second one was a program I saw last week in northeastern Uganda. So community which is split, you know, Christian, Muslim, slightly suspicious. You know, it's a bit more like do you support Everton or Liverpool than real ethnic conflict, although open to debate, I suppose. So again, what we're doing is we're working with the political leadership, the district council, population of 300,000 in the district, very, you know, rural in a way we don't understand. So again, working with these, you know, emerging leaders, teaching them to facilitate, to build the capability of the next people, who build the capability of the village elders, who then help the village work out what resources they have and raise pigs or grow turkeys or make honey, whatever it is. Again, of the 300,000 people in the district, in one way or another, we've touched 60,000 of them. So, you know, this is scale. But what it's doing is building the capability of the leaders, because, you know, those lead facilitators will be the future leaders of Uganda, and also making an impact on the ground at scale. Now, why is that the British Council and not DFID? It's because of the leadership thing. It's jointly funded. DFID want the outcomes. They want the reduced poverty. You know, we quite like that idea too. But the reason we're prepared to do it and invest time and effort in it is because we're developing this leadership capability in a society that doesn't have it. And just hearing the youth association in a particular village saying, look, you know, this side of the road we're Christian, that side of the road we're Muslim, that's why we put the office over here, we're having the meeting on this side of it, and we're learning from each other and how to do that. Because we didn't grow up this way. And that's the point. This is education, but not in a classroom sense. So our contribution, I think, is giving you the example of what we're doing in Tunisia, with Young Arab Voices, but we're not doing it in every country in the Middle East and North Africa and the Gulf, and maybe we should be. And equally, the Active Citizen Program in Uganda, well, that should be done in many, many more countries as well. So I think the next stage in Britain's soft power is to say, what are these great things we're doing, but let's just do them at a more evenly distributed level and maybe to a higher level as well. The other thing, advantage I think we have as the UK is, funnily enough, the English language. We teach English to hundreds of thousands of people a year. And it's about teaching English, but it's really about connecting them with the world. That's always been the goal. It's connecting people who will then go on to do other things, who will travel the world. In the old days, it was that they'd get on the boat or the plane and they'd end up in the UK and they might go to university here, but they couldn't do that if they didn't speak English. They couldn't do it if they didn't have an exam, people believed, which is why we got into the exams area. So, the Chief Minister of the Punjab, one of the things, he says very proudly is, I sat a British Council exam. Because of that, my results were believed. It wasn't that, my rich uncle paid off the examiner, and therefore I got into university, and now I'm the Chief Minister of the Punjab. And we get credit for that. We weren't there, but we get credit for that. And the other example is the mayor of Seoul. We taught him his English, and that connected him with the world. And he's now wants to connect Seoul with London, two global cities. Is there stuff we can do together? Now, that's a long game. That was 40 years ago we taught him his English. But the next mayor of Seoul was probably in the classroom the day I met him. And that's what we do with our English program. Art is another area. The document in 1940 talks about using the cultural resources of the United Kingdom, defined very broadly. Often people think of high culture, but it really means science, it means language, it means education, it talks about governance, it talks about invention, it talks about the national character. So it used the whole spectrum for this engagement. So no surprise that we use art to do it, because it creates these connections. And it creates space for people to have conversations they couldn't otherwise have. My example for that is a few months ago, if you went into the ground floor of our building, a couple of hundred yards away, you would have seen a series of photographs by artists who had been displaced from Syria. And what we asked them to do was to set up an exhibition which captured the impact that the the war was having. And one, for example, was a photograph by a lady. She interviewed people who were fleeing and said, what was the one thing you put in your bag when you were going? And one example was somebody said, well, I put a tube of hand cream. Well, why did you do that? Because when I want to think of my sister who's staying behind, I unscrew the cream and I smell it and I'm there with my sister. And that was one of the photographs. Now, it was a classic art launch in London. There were 120 people in the room, and the white wine was warm, and the canapes were cold. But there were 10,000 people watching on Twitter. And so cultural relations, I think, in the future will be a very different thing. So this, so art and the use of art and our ability to connect people to it in a way in the future will be very different in the past. In the past, there was a danger it was elitist, and we do high art, but only some people like that. The theatre, well, to go to a theatre in Kampala, you're going to be, a particular type of person voting for a particular party, probably. So using that intelligently in the future is another one of the aspects. And I talked about education. And I think the challenges of education systems are enormous. 50% of people under 25 in South Africa have no work. And South Africa is a relative success story. Now, how you do that and how you support them, it's partly around how do we help the economy grow. It's partly how do we make sure that the education people get gives them a skill. So the work we're doing is teaching entrepreneurship. So you can leave with your qualification, but can we help you maybe set up a small business? Because, you know, it isn't going to come from more government jobs, and it isn't going to come from more mining in South Africa. And you see the impact of where the system fails in the huge migration that's happening. We're aware of the one of people crossing the Mediterranean, but the internal migration. You know, South Africa is really worried about the migration to South Africa from other countries. And when if you drive in from the airport, there's a poster saying we do not support xenophobia. It's a real social issue. And the way to solve that is to help education systems equip people with the skills they need to not necessarily get a job, but to create a job. And that's why the digital entrepreneurship work that we do, the social entrepreneurship work we do, is so important. Because these people will be leaders of something. And you'd rather they were the leader of a successful business than a leader of the next extremist group. So this idea of alternative pathways, I suppose, is the next piece of the soft power jigsaw. Martin Rose, one of our colleagues, talks about you want to change the landscape of the mental territory that allows extremism to take hold. And that's about having conversations with people. It's about finding a way of reaching into society across countries which changes or at least subtly adjusts the prevailing narrative, so it can be about optimism and opportunity, not about unemployment and despair. And doing that in the same way that, in Ebola, it was a major, major task to change the funeral rites of people who had been doing it that way for hundreds of years. But you can do it if you have an authentic, open, honest conversation with people. So if we have an authentic, open, honest conversation around the skills you need to be employable, are not just rote learning in an engineering school, actually you're going to need what we would call here life skills, then that's the kind of conversation you can have with the Minister of Education, and we're good at that here. So again, it's about bringing the cultural resources of the United Kingdom to bear on world problems. There are some other changes that we see in how soft power is going to need to respond. Influence is moving away from states to cities to people. So the idea that cultural diplomacy is country to country, yes it is. And there's some good examples. We continued with the year of cultural exchange with Russia despite the Crimea, despite everything else that was going on, to keep those doors open. So I think that is legitimate. But equally, the Mayor of Seoul and the Mayor of London will be part of the equation. Equally, it'll be the school in Bath that has a twin in Kampala for two schools for physically handicapped children exchanging ideas. That's part of it as well. So these connecting real people, and the change in digital will challenge all of us in that. But what's common is that it was always about telling the story as it truly is. If I read a couple more paragraphs from that 1940 annual report, it would talk about this isn't about cultural propaganda. This has to be honest, it has to be open, you have to admit the flaws of your own society, and the reason you have to do that is because you want it to be a proper relationship, not just a piece of broadcast, and you have to be prepared to be changed yourself by it. So I guess my view, and the reason I was excited to join 6 months ago, was that I think the opportunity to get this right, and get it right at a different scale, exists. And I think we know how to do it. We just need to be a bit more joined up, because it's not only the British Council that plays in this, but DCMS have a role as well, and the great cultural institutions have a role, and creating this community of people who buy into the fact that soft power has a greater role, and it's a lot cheaper than a small war to get this right. So let's actually focus on that. And it's getting into the debate, because If you're into political science, you know, there's this kind of realist view of the world which says you have to carry a big stick. It's kind of true. There's the institutional view of the world, which is where the kind of European Union philosophy would come from, saying if you create connections between institutions, then you can do things together as states. And there's a constructivist view, which is probably where we would sit as the British Council, saying if you can change people's experiences, in the long run you end up with something different than if you don't. And the truth, of course, is we have to look through each of the lenses. My fear is that we haven't been paying sufficient attention to this cultural relations soft power agenda. And if you look at the amount of money that traditionally we invest in it as a country, we're what, 1% of the development assistance budget. We would argue we're a very good 1% comparatively of that, and with spending review, if any of you are in the Treasury, 2%, 3% would be fine, thank you very much. But we need to catch on to this thing, which was really the message I was trying to get across in the title of the talk, saying we have to anticipate the causes of what we're seeing and intervene, not just deal expensively with the symptoms when we have them. So for that program working in eastern Uganda, dealing with a population of 300,000, is probably going to cost us £50,000. It's nothing. It's buttons. We can have a big impact, and we can leverage that for stability in that part of Uganda. And if any of you were in Uganda 10 years ago when the LRA were around and the massacres that were taking place, you'll understand why that is an important issue. And it's not an issue we're isolated from. These things do travel. Intercommunal strife between the Christians and Muslims of Kenya and Uganda, we would hear about it. So I'd probably stop there and just say, I think what we need to do is remember what we've been good at as the UK. We've been good at creating these connections. We've been good at building relationships with the people who will be the leaders of the world in 20 or 30 years' time. One in seven world leaders have had a British education. That is not an accident. They did study here. They did study here because we were connected, our education system was connected. 49% of people who want to study in the UK have had a British Council experience, through one of our fairs or whatever. That's why they know they want to come here. So we must remember what we're good at, we must remember the BBC World Service and what's good about it, and build on that for the future. And if we do that and we work with the clubs that already exist, whether it's the British Council or the Commonwealth or the World Service or whatever it is, then we can punch much harder for as the UK in a world which really needs this sophisticated full-spectrum approach. That's the end of the homily. I'd be delighted to take questions, awkward or otherwise. Thank you very much.